Welcome to another episode of We Are Carbon. I'm Helen Fisher and I had the wonderful opportunity to chat with Serenity Hill, co-founder of the Open Food Network, a not-for-profit that is driving significant change and regeneration within our food systems. Serenity comes from a long line of farmers on both sides of her family and has grown up with a keen awareness of the challenges and contradictions of balancing the needs of nature and the needs of farmers within a centralised food system that does a poor job of supporting either. A regenerative farmer herself, she founded the Open Food Network alongside her partner Kirsten in Australia. And with over a decade of evolution, the work continues to expand, supporting fair, local, transparent food distribution in over 20 countries. This is the alternative path to our established, unforgiving commodity markets, and it is empowering food producers and conscious eaters to all become a part of it. I'm delighted that Serenity is here to share on her motivations and continued ambitions. I hope you enjoy.
So, I'm Serenity. I live in Warrumbane in Australia. I grew up on a farm. My parents, on a beef and sheep farm, and I have had a long and winding journey through lots of different things. My early career was in the public service, in sustainability, and in kind of government, until creating Open Food Network and this whole journey with my partner Kirsten about 10 or 12 years ago. And now I'm a farmer myself on that family farm and exploring that alongside work in Open Food Network.
Fantastic. It's really lovely to have you here. And bringing together these sort of ideas, this sort of sustainability focus, the farming focus, and then co-founding the Open Food Network, which is now a very global and significant enterprise. I'd love to hear a little about your motivation to bring this together and to found the Open Food Network. Where did that stem from?
Well, it came from my experience growing up and the context of growing up in a small family farm and the challenges that my parents felt when they were, they were involved in early in the land care movement in Australia. So very environmentally minded, really wanting and trying to do the right thing, but always constrained by the commodity markets and the system that they were selling into, and that driving a way of managing the land harder than what they would have wanted. And I kind of observed that, and I didn't want to rush into farming as soon as I left school. I wanted to go and, save the world. And I thought that you do that through getting involved in institutions and government so I, studied environmental things, and I got a job in sustainability in the government. And I soon learnt after, 5 years and in that system, kind of how the system worked and how frustrated, and I was very, very frustrated at the incrementalism within that system and how it wasn't touching on the kind of deeper issues. I was really interested in what are the kind of alternatives to that system. I started and did most of a PhD, which enabled me to kind of sit back and get right involved in the theory and deep kind of like thinking about the food system and constraints on the food system. At the same time, there was quite a burgeoning kind of social enterprise community happening in Melbourne, and I became more aware of kind of alternative ways of thinking about things, alongside Kirsten, my partner, who had that experience in government and then an experience of kind of going into universities and exploring broader ideas. At the time of this And so we then consciously decided together to do a trip overseas. We went to the US and we looked at kind of local food and alternative food systems over there. And we talked to people working in alternative distribution in Australia as well, because we were particularly interested in, well, there's all these amazing ways to produce food, but how are those farmers properly kind of supported? And funnily enough, yeah, we sort of launched into this because we knew we wanted to come back to the farm, but we wanted to have all of our, you know, markets and stuff sorted out before we did that. So we naively kind of like started, we thought, oh, well, you know, this seems to be a solution to this problem that we're hearing from multiple people in Australia and overseas about this distribution issue, and that technology was a particular kind of bottleneck and issue that alternative food hubs and people doing different kind of social enterprise models were having. So we're like, okay, we'll have a go at that. So a decade later, we're just starting off getting the farm going, because that was a bigger chunk of an issue than we thought, and an ongoing kind of issue, I suppose. And we it was very, very strong and very clear initially that we looked at the industrial food system and all of the kind of principles and things that we could see were dysfunctional about that, and we wanted to create a system that worked in the opposite way. So that was, you know, open source and shared and enabled collaboration and based on trust and human-centered and diverse, and all of these things, supporting farmers and supporting small businesses along the way, and enabling a kind of networked response, because we saw and we still see people getting excited about and wanting to do amazing things in the food system, and then, you know, that their bit is so hard, and then they kind of like, if they're the first ones in their area, then they have to, you know, do all of these other parts of the food system all on their own. And it's like, how do we get collaboration? How do we get scale through collaboration? How do we work together on these problems to kind of share the load? So they're the sort of motivations in the kind of design of how we sort of envisioned Open Food Network from the start, and are still at the kind of heart of the organization. Yeah.
Thank you. That's wonderful. It's very clear that the idea of taking a holistic view of the food system came through early on, and you had these different viewpoints, both with yourself and Kirsten, bringing those different experiences, different skill sets to this, and seeing it from the point of view of the farmer and understanding the challenge of the commodity market, rather than that government system that's very detached. So it's clear it's birthed inside you this knowing that, you know, we need to be more interconnected, and we need to bring that forth into the way that we pull the food into the supply chains. How do we take it from the farmers to the consumer in a fair manner? You mentioned at the beginning of this that the motivation that came from seeing your family and their desire to work with the environment on the farm. If we could just go back to that just for a sort of little bit. Did you find that they had some very sort of stark experiences that made them want to work more in harmony with the environment? Or was that just something that they always was quite resonant with?
I think both my dad's family and my mum kind of, my mum was always, she grew up on a farm. Actually, all my grandparents' families, They're all farmers, and all kind of come from Scotland, and you know, very close in like the UK. So, but my mum, yeah, she'd grown up on a farm near a creek, and her mother was a passionate gardener, and she had kind of naturalists around her, and from a very young age, she was a naturalist. So she'd always wanted. She's part of, like, you know, the bird observers and field naturalists and all of these other things. And then so land care was a very natural thing for her to kind of fall into, but she's a real real farmer as well. So she was like, how do you marry this kind of production versus kind of biodiversity right from when I was very young? And she she's a person who notices things. So when we were growing up, you know, you sort of learnt how to kind of notice what was going on. My dad's family is interesting because my great uncle was a very intelligent and observant man. And in the 40s, when they were first bringing in tractors and all of this stuff, like he was reading reports on soil erosion and like what something's not right here. And in the 70s, he experimented with biodynamics and they built one of the first like key line dams in the region in Australia from P.A. Yeomans, who was influenced kind of permaculture. I remember when I was a kid, my grandmother talking about permaculture. This is like in the 80s, like really early. So I think I had already had these seeds of like alternative thinking, and I was always brought up to be, you know, independent thinker. Like, why are we, you know, doing that? But still the strength of the system is so strong in terms of the other influence of like, you know, having to produce and survive and all of this sort of stuff. So and then, yeah, Landcare, the valley where my farm is and where I grew up was the first place that dry land salinity was identified in Australia, which was, that was the thing that terrified local farmers because it was like black salty scalds on the land related to a shifted water table, which related to previous clearing of vegetation. And there was a sort of a war footing in terms of what is this thing that's happening to us? We have to band together. And that, funnily enough, was actually the start of Landcare in Victoria and Australia. And a lot of the history sort of tells of, you know, warm and fuzzy community and we're doing all the things for the environment. But actually it was the land degradation coming to actually impacting production. And So I think there was like a lot of, and so then when I was a kid in the schools, there was like building models of how the landscape worked and things because of that, like, all of that activity around land care in the 80s, which was very influential on me.
Yeah, it's very powerful stuff to hear it from both angles that, it's clearly the intention to work with nature has been there from both parents and, yes, and their desire has been very strong to do that regardless. But then the motivation also being driven by, well, you know, we need productivity and the land is actually being threatened now by the way that people are farming, by the way that it's being managed. So that the choice was really not, there wasn't a choice to ignore the way that people are approaching the land. It's something that it seems very, very strong, and yet you're still struggling at the current food system, the system, yes, that you find yourself supported by. It doesn't matter how strong the desire is to work in harmony with nature, the system is actually going to, yes, almost not punish you, but leave you at a disadvantage for doing that. For people who aren't familiar with farming and that system, could you explain a little bit about what those challenges were that your parents found themselves with?
Well, that are still here alive and well. I don't think the challenges have changed. I think that, yeah, so there's in Australia, there is, a long-term decline in soil health due to, you know, high inputs and the way that the land has been managed. And that means that sort of the underlying productive capacity of the land is reducing. In the meantime, the amount of money that people are getting for their produce has been declining over many decades, and there is this pressure to put inputs on to be able to keep the level of production high enough to be able to kind of feed your own family, and so the costs are getting higher and higher. And in the meantime, there's obviously droughts. Like, there was a very serious drought when I was a young girl, and then again throughout, you know, becoming more regular in Australia. So you've got these climatic things, prices, you know, commodity prices, you just, you're not in control of those, and you just, yeah. And so these huge challenges that, like, mainstream farmers are unbelievable in how they're kind of, you know, stretch themselves inside out to try and, like, manage these kind of external challenges, and sort of think, oh, there's something wrong with me because I'm not being able to be a good enough kind of farmer. But the system is just so utterly and completely stacked against them, and it's getting much worse. Than, I mean, I'm talking about my experience kind of growing up, and that informed me, but, you know, that was a while ago now. Like, I'm 45, and it's got much, much, much worse. Yeah, so that's a bit of the issue. And I suppose that the situations that are creating that are increasing corporate control of the system and concentration of control to a few companies in all the supply chains, both internationally and then nationally, all the way through in terms of the initial processing and distribution, and then right through to retail in Australia, as is everywhere else. We've got a hugely concentrated retail market for kind of groceries, and that's, yeah, that just works in the and then the policy development process, the corporate food industries involved in developing policy. The big agriculture is involved in and gets all the resources for R&D in agriculture. The universities are controlled. So it all points of kind of information, research, and the whole supply chain, it's stacked against farmers, and it's continuing to get worse because the large corporations are controlling the policy agenda.
Mm. Yeah, and that was very interesting to hear from you earlier on about how you felt that a good avenue for change would be to go into the education system, to go into government even, and say, well, you know, this is my focus. I'm going to change the system from that central place.
Yeah.
And actually that just leading to frustration. And I think it was wonderfully timed and beautiful that you brought it up, that the social enterprise was something that was a movement almost in that time frame. And I'd be very grateful if you could explain that to people just a little bit, of what it means to have a social enterprise and how that differs, if people don't quite understand what that means.
Mm. So it's kind of having a for benefit or for purpose. So you've got an organisation and it's purpose is to do good, whatever that is, and the way that it generates revenue, generates resources to do that good, is through running a business. And in the case of Open Food Network, we've got kind of a non-profit structure, and we, you know, we run services and kind of enterprises, but we also get grants and run like a traditional non-profit. But fundamentally, social enterprise is about doing enterprise with a good purpose.
Mm. That sums it up really well. So thank you very much. It's great to hear all of that as a kind of background to where you are now. And the Open Food Network has been going for a long time, and you've developed the technology, and it's being utilised across the globe. Could you share a little about what the Open Food Network is at its core and how it operates?
Goodness. So, well, the Open Food Network as a technology, and then there's the Open Food Network as an organization. As a technology, it's open source, so it's designed as public infrastructure that can support a better food system, where there's a way that collaboratively we can put resources in globally to build the same infrastructure that is going to support us all. So that's one way of looking at it. It's networked e-commerce, so it enables farmers and other enterprises along the food chain to sell food, and to do that in a way where the supply transparency is maintained. So creating kind of fairness and access to kind of that technology for those smaller enterprises. That's the kind of basis for it. It has a lot of tools to enable small scale co-ops and community food enterprises and supply chain partners to farmers to run their business. Then we've developed that as a kind of an online digital platform, and the future and where we're looking to build Open Food Network out is much more about looking at the interoperability and connections between, well, here's a digital tool over here and here's another one over here and here's another one over here for a farmer or an enterprise. And I want to be able to use all those together to meet my needs. And so us working to be able to enable that kind of interoperability and that flexibility to put together solutions rather than necessarily, well, here's a tool that's going to do all the things that you need to do. So as a community, Open Food Network is a peer learning and sharing community where in different countries and within Australia, within different regions of Australia, we've got people who are working on the same issues and having the same challenges and working through solutions, and it's so much more powerful to be able to share and kind of learn from in other contexts and to kind of share that learning and also share, you know, how hard it is and to have a kind of support community and recognizing that, you know, it does really, really help to have this kind of the longevity and the community to be able to go, well, this is really hard where we are and everyone that we're working with, it's really, really hard. And there would be a tendency if you weren't connected with what was going on more broadly to go, well, that's something that we're doing wrong. You know, that must be our fault. Like it must be, you know, someone else has worked this out. But what you've soon realized when you're in conversation is that no, these structures that we're trying to, you know, fight against and build positive things against are really, really hard. And the things that we're trying to do are really complex. It's very heartening and useful to have a community to talk those things through with.
I'm stepping in quickly before we continue with Serenity. In the spirit of the ever-evolving and collaborative nature of this work, this discussion was brought together by Nick Weir, who also joined us. Nick helped to start the Open Food Network here in the UK, and I think it's a wonderful glimpse of how all of this continually expands. Nick is now at the start of a new project called The Power of Food, which continues the connections outwards as the OFN is coming together with two additional wonderful food-focused projects, the Larder in Lancashire and the socially engaged artistic practice of Living Justice. The Power of Food is a project I'm really excited about, and I'm looking forward to being able to share more with you in an upcoming episode. Be sure to subscribe so you can keep up to date on that, and here's a little input from Nick now as we go on with our conversation.
I love that distinction between the OFN as technology and the OFN as a organisation, and I wonder if we could take it even a stage further, that the OFN is also the seed of local food systems which engage a much wider community. So what we're seeing in the UK is the emergence of food hubs, which I know is happening in Australia as well, where it's not just one farmer who finds a route to market for their produce. It's in some cases that farmer then saying, well, my neighbour also has got produce and I could sell their produce and we could start to connect together. Or in some cases, people who care deeply about the food system but aren't farmers themselves, who come together like me and say, I want to connect all of my local farmers to the people who are eating the food, whether that's households or cafes and restaurants, or whether it's schools and hospitals and so on, and using the OFN technology to create this amazing local mycelium that connects all the farmers to each other, connects the farmers to the hubs, maybe connects the hubs to each other, so the hubs can start trading, and you end up with regional food systems. But that greater than that new food system is a whole social system and a whole learning network, and the hubs sharing information and sharing ideas and learning from each other. And that for me, as much as I'm excited about the technology, what makes me almost beside myself with excitement is the social, the social and the bringing back of meaning, the bringing back of community, which I feel has been lost by the mainstream globalized food system. And I don't know, Sorrent, if you want to reflect a bit on that. Is that, I mean, I'm sure that is the case in Australia too, that there's this, that it's the technology is so much, is the beginning of something rather than the end.
Yes, that's right. Of people coming together and solving solutions together, solving problems together. Yeah. I'll just, yes.
Thank you. It's very lovely to listen to both sort of all three aspects of that, because it's very clear that the challenge is great, and it's such a difficult thing to go about change. And if you're already needing that change because you're in a bad position, or you're finding that you're up against something that is really pushing you into a bad spot, then you're all the more sort of suffocated by that challenge. How do you make steps forward? And I think that what Nick has sort of brought into that there is that sense of, it's almost like a camaraderie. If you are experiencing it in isolation, you're less likely to take steps forward. But when you see other people go, well, yes, it's a challenge and we don't have all of the answers, but why don't we figure it together? And we can do this little bit and this little bit. And sometimes that social aspect is enough just to link it together, to stand by and keep chipping away at the problem, I suppose, rather than just giving up and saying, well, we've got no other option. And it sounds like an ever-evolving entity, the Open Food Network.
Yes, and I would say that sort of where we've, in kind of Australia, in the last couple of years, the other element is kind of taking this common experience that we have with enterprises working in Open Food Network and more broadly, and really starting to identify these patterns of kind of challenges, and one being that we're trying to create these food systems with all this amazing kind of public good, and the resourcing in the system is not there. So there is a real argument for public investment and philanthropic investment to support these values-based supply chains. So we've got much more kind of vocal around advocacy around the investment of those resources and the business case for governments and others to be subsidizing and investing in these enterprises. So I think that's the sort of the next level. It's being able to, as a larger group, kind of problem identify together and then work together to get the collective resources into the system.
Yeah, that's lovely. So the sort of evolution of the scale that you can come together at to then almost create templates, I suppose, and it's never quite cookie cutter templates, but that you can stepping stones on the success of other projects that then brings in confidence from those investors and those new projects.
Yes.
That, you know, it has to sort of start small and then scale up and bring people together. it would be really lovely if you could draw on some examples in Australia and within the experience that you've had of where the Open Food Network and the community side of it, and it's bringing together in a way that makes you feel very hopeful, that it's making a difference for the producers and those challenges that you are continuing to face.
Yes, there's a couple of, you know, there's examples of regional food hubs that have popped up with the support of Open Food Network and with awesome food systems people working over a long period of time. So one is the Bor Bor Food Hub, which is in Gippsland in Victoria and working in a small town, and has been one of the longest running kind of alternative food hubs. Was birthed about the same time as Open Food Network itself, and it's managed to kind of stay afloat. Many have kind of popped up and then kind of disappeared. So that's supporting, you know, a lot of regional producers of different scales and solving different problems for them. It's recently got funding to launch a cafe, so it's really evolved into a community. A real kind of community hub. It's not like a retail space where you come and, you know, do your shopping. It is a regional hub for people to kind of connect. We've got examples of where groups of farmers in a region are using it together to reduce their administrative burden and to reach different markets together. One really good example is North Arm Farms in New South Wales. We've got examples in the whole of state of Tasmania. There's a statewide network using the Open Food Network called Tas Produce Co, which is using it to kind of coordinate at logistics points food pickup and drop off from farmers to reduce the cost of those kind of logistics and to reach customers. So there's examples of, you know, in Australia of different kind of players in the food system using Open Food Network slightly differently. We have we're working with a hub called Mary Food Hub, and we're also going to be working with the community grocer in Melbourne to explore the use of vouchers. So hubs that are particularly kind of working in kind of food justice context, trying to increase access to food for low income communities. We've got multiple kind of community food enterprises, food hubs that are going to work with us on a larger project around implementing food with dignity through a voucher and subsidy program. So that's a couple of kind of things that come to mind. In all of these instances, though, there is just this constant challenge of making it all add up, which is very hard without the scale of demand. So in Australia, and I know that it's the same in other places in the world, our, you know, environmentally minded, green spending middle class, who you know, we rely on to support these kind of alternative values-based food supply systems is really under pressure, and you know, household income and cost of living pressures are really biting here, and this is having a massive impact on these enterprises in the alternative food sector making ends meet, because there's customers who want to buy from them who can't. So the whole movement, we're really needing to think about how we come up with solutions that work for everybody, not just, you know, solutions that work for people with money, which is obviously not a solution, because so these are the sort of complex challenges that we're trying to come up with collective kind of responses to.
Yeah, it's very clear that it's complicated, and it's ever unique to the situation. And I imagine every hub has a very, very situation-specific story that they could tell. But on the whole, this idea of connectivity to create a scale rather than being a farmer selling in isolation is providing them with the option of saying no to the commodity market, which at the end of the day is the alternative is to just say, well, just sell it at a huge scale, probably just a very limited number of crops, maybe just one monocrop at a huge scale. And it just doesn't give the farmer any option of what their income is going to be or how they're going to respond and respect the land. Yeah. So it's obviously taking so many challenges and using connectivity as a way forward. When you talk about a voucher scheme and subsidies, how is that connected into, where would that money be supported from? Is that something that you can work with larger, even governments with, or is it coming from somewhere else?
Yeah. So we have a grant from Citibank, which is a global bank. We were lucky enough to kind of win a global innovation thing that have given us some investment to trial this voucher scheme, and some of that. So that will allow us to fund the pilot part of it to be pumping through vouchers to the community food enterprises that we're working with. But the aim is to both, we're setting up in Australia, we're setting up a trial fund that can both receive government money, so where there's money available for kind of food relief, both from state and kind of local government, but also philanthropy and at different scales. So we want to be able to work with kind of local food hubs and community food enterprises and go, well, is there an option to be raising money from local businesses who are kind of really engaged with you at a kind of local and regional level, as well as potentially funding from more traditional sources. And so it's a big ship to turn around because there is a lot of nuanced and, you know, bringing some of those players along in the conversation in terms of some of the challenges of the traditional food relief models and systems and whether they're actually kind of working with for people and working for farmers and sort of offering this as, well, if we were putting money into these systems, here's a way that we can put it into a system that's actually supporting these amazing enterprises along the supply chain and supporting farmers and getting great, amazing agroecological food to consumers. So initially we're talking with philanthropy, but we have hope to use that to leverage some government money at different scales as well. And this is the bigger story and that I sort of mentioned before, and the bigger advocacy piece in actually saying what these food systems are doing is, you know, the mainstream food system in Australia, I think it's like creates $76 billion worth of costs or something, and that's supported by a whole lot of government investment. If we could just get a little bit of that government investment and support it over here to a food system that's creating public benefit, that's a bigger conversation that has to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all very interesting, and it feels like it just expands and the complexity increases, but in a way that it's sort of able to keep one hub can sit on the shoulders of another and can learn, and that co sort of peer learning is so valuable and so strong within this that I suppose as you see advances in one area that can be shared, and there's something very lovely about that. And I think what you've touched upon in bringing in the support of different options for money is it sort of then brings me to that sort of question of the value of these systems. And we've been all looking forward towards a project of the power of food that is going to include the OFN in the UK, in collaboration with some wonderful, wonderful partners that are bringing in sort of artistry and the meaningfulness of how we connect to food and what that means in our lives, in both looking after the environment, but mostly that kind of aspect of our wellness and community connectivity and support. And I think it's a beautiful sort of angle to bring this to. We've talked about challenges that need to be overcome and technology that's there, but really it's all about people, and it's about how this wonderful commodity of food is actually so much more than just something that should be there on a spreadsheet for the government to decide how much money to put towards it.
Yes.
I thought it'd be really interesting to hear your thoughts on the power of food. What does that kind of resonate with you, and how does that draw up a vision perhaps of what we can create through ongoing connection?
Well, the first thing I would say is part of the deeper issue with the system more broadly is the fundamental approach of quantification and everything being numbers and being valued by numbers. What we want to create is true value and human connectedness and deeper values. And we need to create physical spaces and opportunities for that authentic relations and coming together as community. And food forever in humanity has always been a way that we do that and a way that people can just come together and be human together, which is rarer than, you know, we would like to think, because everyone's so busy and we're in a world where attention has been kind of stolen from us. No one's got time, no one's got attention, everything's on a surface level. And so creating these actual physical and social spaces in community where people can just come together and have kind of authentic relating is what we need to be solving a whole raft of everything that's wrong at the moment. And I would also say on a kind of physiological level, food that's been produced agroecologically with the help of microbes and huge living organism that is our soil and the plants and the animals in a system. Like, there's an amazing book by an American called David Montgomery, which is What We Are, What Our Food Eats or something, which is about, you know, the nutrient cycling and we are ecosystems that are built on the ecosystems that we're supporting through the food system. So it's not just about a nice idea. It's about what is healthy and needed for our bodies, and our communities.
It adds a whole other layer, doesn't it? Just again, on top of everything else, the idea of how our food is produced is really so integral to our own health. And I think it would be lovely to finish off with a little bit about your own farm, because you said this is part of your journey and you're going forward, obviously, with all these influences of your parents and the food system and the challenges of the food system. So I'd love to hear about how you have decided to manage the land that you have.
So we're farming now in Warrumbane in northeast Victoria in Australia, and the farm is 400 acres. It's called Pakawidgee. We're on Tungurung, Bangarang, Yorta, Yorta country. The farm, initially we've got Australian white sheep, which are a shedding breed, and they're for meat. And we're using regenerative or agroecological kind of principles in the production of that meat, and we're looking at other producing other things as well. So we're doing things like planting trees and having agroforestry, and we're doing regenerative grazing and promoting the perennial native grasses to support the flock and to support the soil health more broadly. And we're doing some things around water management and capturing water in the soil. So basically the farm, the core principle is around increasing plant diversity to support more broadly the biodiversity of the farm and produce great food in the process.
Lovely. Yeah, congratulations. All of these things that you're juggling, it sounds like a fantastic effort to bring everything together. I feel like it might be an obvious question, but do you sell your produce through the Open Food Network?
Oh, yes. Yes, we do. Yes.
Thank you so much. It's a huge pleasure to learn about all the story. It's very complicated, and what you have taken on and pushing forward with is wonderful. It's very inspirational, and it has spread and it is making an impact across the globe. I know that you've got a huge amount of resources, videos that have been produced. I've kind of had a little look myself, some wonderful content that people can look through. So I will make sure we have links for people that they can go and learn more, whether they want to watch what has been achieved or whether they want to learn more about how to utilize the technology themselves. We'll make that all available. Do you have anything yourself that you would like to draw attention to in particular?
No, I think just kind of, yeah, what's out there kind of already, but that's enough. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and it's a great pleasure, and best of luck with everything.
All right. Thank you very much.
And thank you for listening to this episode of We Are Carbon. Be sure to check the description to learn more from Serenity and the Open Food Network. And don't forget to subscribe to keep up to date with everything from We Are Carbon. Keep an eye out for more content connected to the Open Food Network in an upcoming group conversation about the project, The Power of Food. And let's keep figuring this all out together.